Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm Ann Clark, co-chair of the Environment and Natural Resources-led forum. Our program tonight is sponsored by the Business and Leadership Program and the Environment and Natural Resources Program. I will be your chair for this evening's meeting and program, Pebble Mine, Toxic Gold, and Global Impact. It is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished moderator, Wendy Schmidt. Wendy is a Cal Bear. Go Bears. Having received her master's in journalism from Berkeley. And she graduated magna cum laude from Smith College. She is the founder and CEO of the Schmidt Family Foundation and is internationally known for her leadership and work. With her husband, Eric, she has created the Schmidt Technology Fund at Princeton and the Schmidt Marine Science Research Institute. Please welcome Wendy.
Thank you, Anne. Thanks very much. And thank you all for coming out tonight. I know everybody's busy, but this is a really important issue. The mission of our foundation and the 11th Hour Project that I operate out of that foundation is to promote the wiser use of energy and natural resources in this century, recognizing that advances in technology and information and communication systems create new opportunities for humans to meet our needs more in harmony with the natural world. So this topic is incredibly interesting to me. We hear a lot of public discussion nowadays about the Keystone Pipeline, good news today, drilling onshore and offshore, of course, fracking, but we almost hear nothing about this proposed copper and gold mine that would be one of the largest in the world, certainly the largest in the United States, the kind that you can see from space, the Pebble Mine. The project of two foreign national mining companies, this mine would be constructed on a site in southwest Alaska, about 200 miles southwest of Anchorage, at the top of that watershed that feeds Bristol Bay. This is a natural and economic backbone for a generation of commercial and recreational fishermen. So tens of thousands of these people make their living from the richest salmon spawning and trout fishing waters in the world. Estimates of up to 60 million salmon can be found returning here from a single spawning event. And the seafood industry contributes almost $6 billion to the Alaskan economy, along with more than 78,000 jobs. So in a world where salmon fisheries are struggling and collapsing, this is one that is actually thriving. The locals say that salmon is their gold. It returns every year. The proposed Pebble Mine, as I said, is massive. It's an open pit mine, 2,000 feet deep and 2 miles wide, with an underground mine up to a mile deep. And yet, considering the impact of the scale, most people don't know that the particles of gold that would be mined here are so microscopic that in some cases you could fit more than 200 of them on the head of a pin. Gold's uses for jewelry, obviously, especially in growing markets like India and China, and for electronics like computer motherboards, for industrial uses, dental uses, and for investment coins and bars, have expanded rapidly in a market that grew from $32.5 billion in 2001 to more than $157 billion in 2010. But discoveries of gold are increasingly rare. In all of human history, only about 161,000 tons of gold have ever been mined, and that's just enough to fill two Olympic-sized swimming pools. More than half of that has been mined in the last 50 years alone. There's a similar story for copper. 95% of all copper ever mined has been extracted since 1900. World discoveries of copper peaked in 1996, while demand continues to grow for products like electronics, cooling and refrigeration tubing, heat exchangers, water pipes, and yes, jewelry. The Pebble Mine area excites geologists so much because it's the second largest deposit of its kind ever found. It's also one of those remote and fragile places on the earth that's left to mine. The question we have here is at what cost, and who really bears these costs? Fluctuating supply and demand in the market for mined metals directly impacts the demand for recycled or scrap gold and copper. And dwindling world supplies of mined copper could soon create a permanently growing market for scrap copper. According to current estimates, the construction of Pebble Mine would generate more than 10 billion tons of earthen waste. laced with toxics. That's almost 3,000 pounds for every person on Earth. In addition, there's the waste to come from the mine's operations. Gold is usually separated from rock with the use of mercury, both in liquid and gas. So the tailings, or the sludge residue from daily operations, would need to be forever kept behind these earthen berms that are proposed to be built. They're 70 feet high, holding everything back in an earthquake-prone geography from one of North America's primary freshwater systems. So as you know, metal mining is fundamentally a destructive business, and hard rock mining is the number one most polluting industry in America. Some mining companies have spent huge sums to help mitigate the impact of their operations on the surrounding landscapes, and the Advocates for Pebble Mine insist that fish can subsist along with copper mining, and they will protect this sensitive area. The question at Pebble Mine is, could this ever be enough? Is this mine different? And could this be the place where Americans can begin to transform an industry and a marketplace, to take it from a system that depends on waste, in the destruction of habitats and industries, and in the threats to human health and fresh water supplies, to something that depends on the more efficient use and marketing of recycled gold and copper? In the meantime, the development of Pebble Mine has proceeded amidst lots of local controversy and tense opposition for almost a decade, with exploratory drilling underway and permits for water use issued by the state of Alaska. In the Bristol Bay region, despite the promise of new jobs, opposition to the project has been running in excess of 80%. We're fortunate tonight to have with us three leaders in the battle against Pebble Mine. I'll start with the most unlikely opponent, Michael Kowalski, chairman and CEO of Tiffany & Company. 6 years ago, under Mr. Kowalski's leadership, Tiffany became the first jeweler to sign on to the No Dirty Gold campaign. Since then, Tiffany has pledged that the company would not source any of its gold from Pebble Mine and has urged other jewelry companies to follow suit. To date, more than 60 major jewelers have now taken the pledge, in essence, biting the hand that feeds them by rejecting in advance any association with a mine they say does not represent the best use of our resources. We're also joined by Kimberly Williams, executive director of Nunamta Alushke. Have I said that right?
Close.
Alukeste. 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 Which means, in the local Yurok tongue, caretakers of the land. She lives in one of the leading fishing communities in southwest Alaska called Dillingham, where she and her family have been fishing commercially for generations. Nunamta is an association of eight village corporations in the Bristol Bay region, where it is leading the strong opposition of Native Alaskans to the Pebble Mine. And finally, we're joined by Joel Reynolds, Senior Attorney for the Natural Resources Defense Council and the Director of its Save Bristol Bay campaign. NRDC is a national and international advocacy organization with a staff of 400 and more than 1.3 million members and activists working on a broad range of environmental issues all around the world. Based in Los Angeles, Mr. Reynolds has more than 30 years' experience as an environmental litigator and has twice been named California's Attorney of the Year in the environmental category. So let's begin our discussion tonight of the Pebble Mine with Joel Reynolds. Joel?
Thank you very much, Wendy, and thanks very much to the Commonwealth Club for hosting this event. Thank you all for coming. I'd like to do two things in my, over the next 10 minutes. First, describe the place and the problem of Pebble Mine, including some remarkable photographs by renowned wildlife photographer Robert Glenn Ketchum. Second, I'll summarize where the project stands today and where I think it's headed. I should warn you at the outset that in talking about Pebble, I often feel like I'm lapsing into a rage of hyperbole, which is how I feel about this project. But it's a fact that in all my years of environmental work, I've never seen a project more deserving of attack than this one. If we can't, in the 21st century, if we can't stop a project like the Pebble Mine, then I think we have to fear for the future of our planet. It's a fact that in areas of high groundwater, virtually all large mines leak eventually. And because of its hydrology, if it's built, the Pebble Mine will leak too. And when it does, it will contaminate the watershed, endanger one of the world's great fisheries, and impoverish the communities that have relied on it for thousands of years. The fundamental problem is its location at the headwaters of the Bristol Bay watershed, a 40,000 square mile ecosystem in southwest Alaska that feeds the most productive wild salmon fishery in the world, surrounded by national parks and preserves, the largest state park in the country, Woodtichick State Park, and the largest freshwater body in all of Alaska, Lake Iliamna. I want to emphasize two things at the outset tonight. First is that this is not just about the Pebble Mine. You can see from this slide that there are a host of mining claims all queued up, waiting to see what happens at the Pebble Mine. So as Pebble goes, so goes the entire watershed. Second, the region is inundated by water. This is a Robert Glenn Ketchum photo of Lake Iliamna. This is another view of Lake Iliamna from the perspective of the mine itself. This is Frying Pan Lake, which, if the mine is built, would be at the bottom of a massive tailing pond. This is another Ketchum photograph of the tundra-like terrain where the mine would be sited. Again, water everywhere. This is Lake Clark National Park, and this is what it's like inside the park. That's not a Ketchum photograph, but that is me fishing. This is a photo of Woodtichick State Park. Absolutely fantastically beautiful place. And another. And there is a wealth of species diversity. Fish, land mammals, marine mammals, birds. The superstar is the salmon. 30 to 50 million of them return each year, literally turning the rivers red in the summer. A wealth of grizzlies and brown bears, which love the salmon as much as people do, or perhaps more. And one of my personal favorites, the beluga whale, an endangered population that, if the mine is built, would receive a brand new deep water port right in the middle of its Cook Inlet habitat. This is the wrong place for one of the world's largest mines, but that's exactly what the consortium of foreign mining companies led by Anglo-American, Rio Tinto, and Northern Dynasty Minerals has in mind. A gigantic open pit 2 miles wide and 2,000 feet deep, an underground mine a mile deep, together generating 10 billion tons of waste laced with toxics, to be retained on site forever behind five dams, each larger than the Three Gorges Dam in China. The overall footprint of the project would be 50 square miles, roughly the size of the District of Columbia. There would be a new port, new roads crossing hundreds of salmon streams. The power needed to operate this mine would exceed the power currently used by the city of Anchorage. So this is a graph from the mining consortium. It gives you a sense of what they predict the deposit to look like. And you can see on the left is the open pit going down 2,000 feet, and then the root of that deposit going down a mile to the right. This is a representation of what the earthen dam that would contain this 10 billion tons of waste would look like. The reference there is the Seattle Space Needle, which I'm happy to say is not actually going to be moved to the mine site. For those of you who've never seen what can happen when things go bad at a large-scale mine, this is the Berkeley Pit in Butte, Montana. And I have it here because it represents what the problem is when you try to mine in an area of high groundwater. You have to dewater the site first in order to dig the pit. And you have to keep the site dewatered during the operation of the mine. But when the operation is done, you can't stop dewatering it, because if the pit fills up again, it combines with oxygen and some of the mineral traces in the ground, and it acidifies. And that's precisely what has happened here at the Berkeley Pit, which is a Superfund site now. It's about half the size of what Pebble would be. But the acidity level of the water as that pit slowly refills and approaches groundwater, at which point it will then reverse flow. Instead of filling up the pit, it will actually disperse into the groundwater. The acidity level is equivalent to lemon juice, and it continues to acidify, approaching eventually battery acid. I put this in here simply because it just shows a different worldview. Do not be swayed by those who would lead you to think that this mine would be an ecological disaster. That's a very different picture than the one I just showed you at the outset. The fact is that these mines eventually do leak. This is a study from 2006 of 25 of the largest mines in the U.S., and the conclusion of this study was that 93% of the mines with characteristics similar to that of the Pebble mine violated water quality standards. Now, for a copper mine in a region of salmon, that's a prescription for disaster, because even a small amount of copper, 2 to 3 parts per billion above background levels, is enough to interfere with the ability of salmon to smell and therefore to return and therefore to survive. So what's at stake in Bristol Bay? $450 million a year in commercial and recreational fisheries revenue. That's almost $500 million. An annual run of 30 to 50 million salmon. Now, in Oregon and California and Washington, we fight to preserve a salmon run of 3 to 5,000. And this is 30 to 50 million. Thousands of jobs, permanent and seasonal, associated with the fisheries. And there's a subsistence fishery that has sustained native communities for millennia. This is a map that shows the stronghold in the world for Pacific sockeye. And as you can see in the dark blue in the area of Bristol Bay, that's the region that we're talking about. In the words of Interior Secretary Ken Salazar, this is a treasure that we have to preserve for future generations. So what does Anglo American, the 50% owner of the project, say? They say that they will not proceed with the mine if it threatens the environment or the fishery. They say they won't proceed with the mine if the local communities don't want them to. So what do the local communities say? Every single poll that's been taken up in that area has found overwhelming opposition. In the Bristol Bay region, the opposition is in the neighborhood of 80%. Within the state of Alaska, it approaches 60%. NRDC just did a poll in the lower 48 where this mine is really very little known. But what we discovered was that the more you tell people, pro or con, about the project, the more the opposition grows. And the opposition in the lower 48, according to our poll, is 77%. Overwhelming opposition. And people are just beginning to hear about it. It's a remarkable coalition, actually. And it includes commercial fishermen, recreational fishermen, sportsmen, Republicans, Democrats, men, women. The Bristol Bay Native Corporation is the largest developer in the region. It's a billion-dollar developer, Native-owned, opposed to the Pebble Mine. The Bristol Bay Native Association, it's an association of some 32 tribes. It opposes the Pebble Mine. We've already heard about the advocacy of Tiffany's, and we're going to hear more about that from Michael Kowalski in a few minutes. Most recently, there was an initiative in the Lake and Penn Borough of Bristol Bay, which is where the mine would be sited. It was an initiative called Save Our Salmon, and the focus of the initiative was to prevent any large-scale resource extraction like the Pebble Mine from proceeding, and that initiative was successful. It's now being challenged in court, both by the Pebble Partnership and by the state of Alaska, as an unconstitutional initiative. This is an example of one of the ads that Tiffany put in the National Geographic. And again, we'll hear more about that in a few minutes. NRDC's focus is to support the local opposition, stop the mine, and encourage permanent protection for the region for mineral extraction. Our focus has four elements: an international campaign challenging the principal mining companies, administrative and legal advocacy to challenge needed permits, pressure on financial institutions likely to fund the project, like Citibank, like Goldman Sachs, like Barclays, and several others, and we've already met with each of them. We've also devoted a great deal of attention to raising the profile of the project in opposition through communications and membership action. We have generated thus far 700,000 petitions of opposition, which we've delivered personally to each of the major partners: Anglo-American in May 2010, Mitsubishi in Tokyo in June of 2010. And the good news is that 6 months later, Mitsubishi withdrew 100% from the project. In April of this year, Kimberly Williams and I and others went to meet with the leadership at Rio Tinto and to speak at their shareholder meeting, a very productive meeting, no outcome, of course, but it's the beginning of a conversation that we hope will lead someplace good. We've done a great deal of paid media in the New York Times and the Financial Times, coinciding with some of the annual shareholder meetings of the major corporations. We've done op-eds, social media. Robert Redford has been very involved in support of our efforts. The latest thing going on is that the U.S. EPA, in response to petitions from some of the native tribes, has undertaken a watershed assessment to determine what the impacts would be of a major mine in this incredible ecosystem. And that's the first step in a process in which EPA, we hope that EPA will intervene and exercise its authority under the Clean Water Act to block this project. A very difficult political lift, and it remains to be seen whether EPA will be able to do that. Finally, the goal here is to create a Bristol Bay Fisheries Reserve. Already in this area of this watershed, oil development is prohibited except under very limited circumstances, and that is the goal eventually for mining as well. So that's a very quick overview of where things stand, what's at stake, and what the major threat is. I'd like now to turn over the microphone to Kimberly Williams.
Thank you, Joel. And I also would like to express my thanks to the Commonwealth Club for raising the awareness on a project that, in my home, Bristol Bay, we are faced with. And so I thank you guys all for coming. I am Ungachuak and Duntukwinuk. I was given these Yupik chiefs' names by an elder, Mary Olympic of Igiagik. I only pray that in my lifetime I can live up to those names. I am also the third chief of the Chulhyung Tribal Council, which asked EPA to come in and step in on our behalf to protect our homeland. And I am the executive director of Nunumpaluxtai. You know, when you go home and you have an education, you get roped into a lot of things, and you get called upon to take on some huge challenges. And like my father, you rise to the occasion and you fight and you keep on going. So in these short 10 minutes, you know, Joel said it all and he kind of stole the doggone thunder. So I'm not going to repeat it, although, you know, if I was a teacher and I taught in the university, I would repeat it three times over so my students would stay awake and they would hear it. And then by the time they walked out, they would understand. But I'm not going to do that. But Nunumpaluxtai is a Yupik phrase. It means caretakers of our land. We recognize that in 2003, we didn't have pebble on the horizon. My father, when he was president of Bristol Bay Native Association back in the 80s, fought the battle with Cominco. Cominco had come up and staked the claims, and they started to do some outreach, and then they walked away, and we didn't hear about them. So in 2003, everybody, the village corporations in Alaska, we had land claims, and so we were all working on our land claims, and we had all these sports hunters and sports fishermen coming into Bristol Bay and trespassing on our lands, and that was the biggest thing for us to fight. We wanted to protect our subsistence lifestyle because those rivers, those are our dinner table. And so we dealt with trespass long before pebble, and our focus was on trespass. But because we're here to talk about pebble, I wanted to say that our membership in Unumpta Luxtai has now grown to 19. We started with 8 village corporations. We added another in 2010. We recognize the value of our tribes to be at the table, and so that the tribes that have are part of our member communities and Bristol Bay Native Corporation, which Joel has just talked about, we have all banded together to fight this fight because it is of utmost importance that we stop it now before it even gets to an application process. But we realize as landholders, and we have land that are located along the rivers. And so if Pebble, if you've looked at watched our video and you've watched this PowerPoint, anything that comes down at the top of this ecosystem, these two drainages where Pebble straddles, will come down our rivers and impact the very thing that we get our food from. And so we have banded together to fight it. And it's worth repeating that we will be left with 10 billion tons of ore to sit there that will eventually will contaminate our rivers. We know that. And what this company, these two foreign companies are after, is just 1% of the precious metals. So in one hand, you say, we all like our rings. Unfortunately, my family is allergic to gold, so we can't wear it. But everybody likes our rings, and we like our computers, and we all recognize that even renewable energy requires copper. And we've also heard the stories that from some of the opposition that, well, you know, people in Bristol Bay, you just don't want it in your backyard. What we don't want is a trade-off. We recognize the need for jobs in our region. We recognize the need that people need to be employed. We recognize, and I'll be the first to tell you, my children love the iPads and the cell phones. We like that. It makes life easier for us in Alaska. It makes life easier for you down here. But it shouldn't come at the expense of a renewable resource like fish that has kept my family going for 10,000 years. We have families in the region. Native people have lived there for 10,000 years. They were drawn there because of fish. And so all we're saying is one should not come at the expense of the other. It was reaffirmed when we had a visioning project back this year that we just had a big, huge meeting. And our people are committed to staying in the region. They want jobs, but they want to live there. They want their fish. And so for us, it is a balance of how do we provide the economic development against this. And what we're saying is there are many opportunities that fish can bring to us that we haven't really focused our attention on. And so the leaders of our region have really banded around this regional visioning process to say, what can we do to make life better so that we don't have to pay the high cost of energy? In my home, gas goes for $6.75 a gallon. It costs a lot to live in Alaska. Now we have snow, and it's so nice to be down here in San Francisco where it's really nice and warm. But Joel kind of talked about the Lake and Peninsula Borough Initiative, and we really, I'm not a part of the borough. We have an east side, west side split of Bristol Bay, and the Lake and Penn, the people of that borough voted and said, we want to save our salmon. And so we want to bring the message back to the foreign mining companies to say, look, hold to your promise that if you are not wanted, you will go away. Well, they voted. And if you added the people of the west side, of which the west side contains a lot more of the people, we would have a resounding no. Bristol Bay Native Corporation has completed a study of its shareholders, and the majority of the shareholders of BBNC do not want this project. We understand the risk. We have made an informed decision, and we say no. But Pebble has learned from our playbook. You know, we've early on connected with the partners, and Tiffany is an unlikely partner. If you looked at Bristol Bay, and if you know anything about fish, when you get the sports fishermen, the commercial fishermen, and the subsistence fishermen together united on one issue, that is amazing. When user groups fight one another on who gets how much fish, they fight to the end. But on this issue, on Pebble, we are very united. And we have to seek out and get partners like Tiffany's. And we hope we can get copper companies to say, no, we don't want to buy no dirty copper. And we've had to connect to the green organizations. It's amazing that if Native people can connect to green organizations. But we've had to. And we all unite on this one issue to say, this is too big of a project and it's too much of a risk. But Pebble has really come in and promised jobs. And if you, some of our partners have been getting letters from the opposition, a Native group that has organized, just like Nunumta, but they're on the side of let's wait. And we're saying we can't wait. So they've been putting pressure on the companies to say, come meet with us, which we thank the partners for doing that. And I think I would say on behalf of, and I can't speak for Nuna, but they are Native people just like I am. They want the same thing. They want jobs, they want their fish, and they want their families to thrive. But where we are different is I will not wait. I will not wait for an application because I know from history that if I waited for an application to come from the Pebble Partnership, it is too late. And we have to stop them before that time. So I wanted to give some thanks to the Moore Foundation because they were one of the first to recognize that people of the region needed a voice. We needed to educate ourselves. We're fishermen. We have no idea what a mine looks like. We had no idea of how big of a mine it was. You tell people it's 10 billion tons. Well, who can even visualize 10 billion tons? So we've had to educate, and thanks to the Moore Foundation, who gave money to the Alaska Conservation Foundation of Alaska, they funded Nunumta, and we've been taking people from the region into Salt Lake City to look at Bingham Canyon, the Kennecott Mine, which is smaller than Pebble, but very similar. And so we've had to educate ourselves and to travel. We've had to travel to London to engage Rio Tinto, an Anglo-American. Who would think that in this day and age where we all want to just put up our fish, Native people want to just put up our fish and fill our freezers with smoked salmon, that we now have to go out and travel and speak at events like this to say, would you please help us to protect our homeland? But they have produced jobs, and people around New Halen and Iliamna will tell you that we do have jobs. But what they won't tell you is that it has already come at the expense of salmon. In the North Fork and the South Fork of the Kuchtuli, not the Cocktuli, but the Kuchtuli River, the king salmon that I and my family prize every year in May and June have already dropped. In Upper Tallarik Creek, or you guys say Tallarik, we say Tallarik, the red salmon, the sockeye salmon, have dropped 83% from 120,000 down to 20,000. That's a return into that river system. They won't tell you that, and that's from Northern Dynasty's own studies. They will quick to tell you that we've got the jobs and we're employing local people, but it today has come at the expense of salmon. And they have a governor who is on their side. And what we really ask for is balance, and unfortunately with politics the way that it is in Alaska, when we got Murkowski, he changed everything, and the subsequent governors, Palin and Parnell, have kind of followed in suit. And so we are up against a state that is not protecting us. In fact, they have intervened on the Save Our Salmon initiative. And intervening means they take the lead, and they take the expense if they lose. And so that foreign mine company that Pebble gets their funding from, they're not on the hook. And so it is not a level playing field. And so we ask for your help. Our tribes have asked for EPA to come in and step in. You can help us by writing to your senator and your congressman and saying, hey, look, if Administrator Jackson makes a decision to implement a 404C, stand behind her. Because for goodness sake, EPA gets beat up all the time. You hear him in the news every time. And unfortunately, my senators in Alaska are usually the ones, or the Representative Young's leading the way to beat up on EPA. So we ask for your help. You can do it by writing a letter. So I want to thank you for listening.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California and our program on Pebble Mine with Mindy Schmidt from the Schmidt Family Foundation as our moderator, Mike Kalinske from Tiffany's and a member of the panel, Joel Reynolds from NRDC, and Kimberly Williams, Numata Aluski, is it? Aluska?
Numata Aluska.
Aluska, thank you.
We're going to need to take lessons.
All right.
Thank you, everyone. It's my pleasure now to have a sort of a question and answer period with Mr. Kowalski from Tiffany's. You've heard about his public stance of his company against Pebble Mine, and I want to ask you, Michael, has the company ever taken a public stance like this before with a potential supplier?
We do have a reasonably long history of opposing irresponsible mine development. I think the first time that we spoke out publicly was the New World Mine back in 1996. It was a gold mine that was proposed for outside Yellowstone Park, and it was really our first exposure to this subject, and we did speak out, and since we've spoken out on a few other mines, Rock Creek up in the Cabinet Mountain Wilderness and a few others around the world.
What's the significance of this particular protest for you in your mind?
Well, I think it's probably really the enormity of this project, and as Joel said, if there was ever a place that deserved to be protected, it would be Bristol Bay. But I think it's important to understand that there's a lot of oftentimes people express surprise that we should be sitting here opposing Pebble, but other mines. But I think it is important to understand that we come at this from a completely commercial point of view. However much personally we may feel, we may agree with the preservation of Bristol Bay, we really do believe, and we concluded this long ago, that when customers come to Tiffany & Company and they purchase diamonds or gold or silver, there's an expectation that those materials will be extracted and processed in a responsible way. It really is a fundamental part of our brand promise. So when we speak out against Pebble, we really believe that we're speaking out on behalf of our consumers. And I think the fact that 60-plus jewelry companies around the world have essentially come to the same conclusion. It may be the right thing to do, but there is also a strong business imperative to oppose Pebble and other like mines, and that's really the heart of our opposition.
I mentioned earlier the market for recycled gold. Mm-hmm. You've been in the industry a long time. Do you see that playing a role in the future of the industry?
Absolutely. At this point, in the case of Tiffany & Company, a significant portion of our gold does in fact come from recycled sources. So I think it will become increasingly important, and I think it will be true certainly of platinum and silver as well. So that's a huge opportunity for the industry to act more responsibly.
And how do you go about educating your consumers and customers mm-hmm. about the responsible sourcing of metals?
Well, we certainly, probably for us, the biggest, the most direct communication vehicle would be our website, and we're about to launch a new it may be up today or tomorrow, a new website addressing issues of environmental and social responsibility. So that's probably our primary vehicle. But I think, customers are aware. Probably the most positive feedback we get is from our customers who write directly, who express their appreciation to our sales associates. And it's the interaction and the dialogue that takes place at the point of sale for those people that care about this issue. I think that's really the primary focus of our communication.
Mm-hmm. One of the questions people ask me when they knew you were coming to be on the panel this evening is, how feasible is it for a company like Tiffany's to track the origins of the gold that you buy from any particular mine? How does that actually work?
Yeah, and that's an important consideration because some of the jewelry companies who have taken the Pebble pledge have in fact been challenged on the reasonableness of that pledge. That in fact, because gold is so fungible, in our case, we manufacture our own jewelry. We know the mine source of origins of the majority of our silver, gold, and platinum. So it is feasible, and I think will become more feasible going forward. But you can't be 100% certain. So there is a legitimate issue for the industry here. But I think if enough of us band together and make an effort to identify those mine sources, it can be done. It's just really hard to do.
Mm-hmm. Another thing I think people would really like to understand from your point of view, How could the global market for copper and gold resources affect the outcome of this battle for Pebble Mine?
Well, I think certainly the price of gold. We all know where the price of gold has gone over the past several years, certainly has changed the economics of Pebble and other gold mines in a positive way dramatically, and so certainly would has the rising price of copper. So rising commodity prices certainly increase the economic incentive for development like Pebble, and I think it just makes it harder for us to say no.
Mm-hmm. As a CEO reporting to your board, to your shareholders, they're interested in good business results. Mm-hmm. So you see a pledge like this as leading directly toward that kind of a future.
Absolutely. And we've been, Tiffany, and I think, again, many of the jewelers who have signed the pledge do have the support of their boards and their public shareholders. I certainly know that when Tiffany is in fact a public company, when we speak about this to our investor relations, to our investors, there is great support because I think, again, it is about the brand promise. It is about driving customer demand. It is about meeting customer expectations for responsibly sourced metals. And that's certainly been a very positive development that's made it easier for us and other jewelry companies to take positions like this. It is in our economic interest.
Have you heard anything from within the industry that argues for the mine? On the other side of that?
No one on the retail side would argue for the mine. I think some folks have decided to stay on the sidelines, and it'd be nice if more people got off the sidelines. But I don't think on the retail side, we all face the same issue of consumer concern and consumer resistance. The mining side, of course, is different.
Good. Well, it sounds like things are changing for the jewelry industry, and perhaps this is a threshold moment for that. Thank you so much for being here with us tonight, and we may have some more questions for you. I'm going to start to bring some questions forward here that are coming to us from the audience. One of them, interesting, maybe this is for you. Which one to start with here? Maybe anybody can jump in here. But I think maybe you're going to have the answer here, Kimberly. How many jobs would be created by the Pebble Mine? What is the claim there? And do these jobs pay more than fishing for the residents of Alaska?
Well, it depends on the jobs. It depends on Pebble. So, you know, as they go through construction, when you have construction jobs, they're putting infrastructure in. So they'll have over 2,000 jobs at the mine site. Mm-hmm. But once it gets going, then that number drops. You put that up against a fishing industry like Bristol Bay, and I think, Joel, you talked about the jobs in Bristol Bay, but my family, they're all commercial fishermen, and my father, who's 73 years old, still fishes commercially, and he employs three people on his boat that he's done for the last 50 years. And so I think you take a renewable resource and jobs like that, and you say we can't afford to lose those jobs. And he employs people from the region. A mining company will have to get their jobs or their employees from outside of Dillingham or outside of the region because we don't all have the expertise to work in a mining company, and we'd all have to get trained, and there are about 7,000 people that live in Bristol Bay. We could all go to work for Pebble if we all had the qualifications, if they got their permits.
Mm-hmm. There's another question for you that just arrived. Can you expand upon why the Native and Green groups don't often cooperate?
Well, I think Native organizations have always said, and if you talk to one of my uncles who's a leader in our region, we live off of subsistence. We kill animals. We eat animals. And that, for some green organizations, just don't fit so well. Conservation groups don't fit so well with that. If you watch the whaling and going after the whaling ships, that's an example of where we wouldn't necessarily have agreement on. And so for us, because we practice subsistence and we eat from the land, some people don't like that. They'd rather get their food. Well, maybe you'd like to eat tofu, but I didn't grow up on tofu. I grew up on salmon and moose and caribou, which requires killing an animal. We do it out of respect, and we eat everything, mm-hmm. but we still do.
I'm going to comment on that briefly, too, because I think one of the the big challenges that we have found from the perspective of NRDC in this campaign is the historic strong resistance within Alaska to whatever a large environmental organization from the lower 48 has to say. And, you know, like it or not, that's what NRDC is. And so from the moment we became engaged in this really remarkable battle, we have strived to make it clear that what we're there for is to support the local opposition, the views of the native communities, the views of the residents in Bristol Bay. Alaska is, you know, renowned for a state in which development is a good thing. Never seen a mine that, well, there's never been a mine that's been rejected in Alaska. Oil development is widely supported industry. So there's just a different view in Alaska, typically, about development than what we have in the lower 48. But the Pebble Mine, one of the things that I find so unusual about it is that it crosses so many boundaries, political, ideological, vocational, cultural, social. This is just one of those projects that we can no longer afford to allow. And that's the way the people in Bristol Bay feel about it. You know, 80%. How unusual is that? That is very unusual when you're finding that level of opposition to a project. And the reason is because it threatens the principal economic engine, not just in the region, but in the state, and that is the fisheries. So NRDC has worked very, very hard to collaborate, to coordinate, and to support. And so far, it's been a very successful partnership, I'm happy to say.
Thank you, Joel. Another question for you. You mentioned in your presentation that the CEO of Anglo American said they will not go into an area and build a mine where there is a tremendous amount of opposition. Okay? The polls are saying no. How do they respond to this right now? What is the conversation going on with all of this opposition that's growing?
Well, I'll start, but I think Kim should definitely respond to that because I know she's met several times with the leadership. Again, this is one of the things that major developers always say. There's certain things they'll always say on any project, any major project, and that is, one, we certainly aren't going to proceed if we're going to hurt the environment. That's a given. And if you believe it, then I've got a blowout preventer that I'm willing to sell you from the Gulf of Mexico. But they're also saying that we're not going to proceed if the people don't want us there. And I think the evidence is already in on that one because the level of opposition is really unprecedented for this project. And Anglo American is basically saying, well, we just have to wait and see. Give us a chance to lay out the project. You know, never mind that we told you it was going to be 2 miles across and 2,000 feet deep and you know, 10 billion tons of waste. Never mind that. Wait till you see what it actually looks like. Give us a chance before you cast your vote. And I don't think that the people of Bristol Bay are inclined to wait. But, Kimberly, it'd be great to hear what Cynthia Carroll has told you directly.
Well, I think she doesn't understand no. It's really clear, because Nunumta Luxtai has been doing surveys of our region of the people. And it's the opposition was at 74%. It's at 79%. Bristol Bay Native Corporation has surveyed their shareholders. It's at 80%. You just had the Save Our Salmon initiative just get passed. It passed. So what part of no doesn't she understand? It's like the local people have made an informed decision. We don't want this project, so go away. Hold to your promise. And they keep saying, well, just wait and see. Wait and see. Well, the wait and see really is wait until we file our permit application. And by then, for us, it is too late.
Here's a question that relates to this conversation. How did these mining companies still have a presence if the majority is against the mine? Who owns the land? Can you describe the claim structure?
Yeah, this project is on state land. And so because it's on state land, the state has the ability to say, and they've changed their area plan. A long time ago, when I was still wet behind the ears and in college, that area plan basically said, we are saving this for habitat. And they've changed it. When Murkowski became governor, he wanted the road to resources. And he changed, basically, he did several things. He took the habitat division that used to be in the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, and he moved it over to DNR, the Department of Natural Resources, to make it easier for development. For many of us in the that rely on fishing, we cried foul, and when Governor Palin came into office, she moved habitat back over to Fish and Game. But by then, you've had all these seasoned employees, these veteran biologists retire. And so even though you've moved them, the problem still remains that you don't necessarily have the capacity within there to really have a balanced discussion about development. And that's what we're up against, mm-hmm. is we just don't have a governor that's willing to say, we want balance, but he's really more development-friendly than anything. And because it's within DNR, the state plays a big role, and that's why we, the tribes, have reached out to EPA to come in and step in.
Mm-hmm. We've talked about the enormous amounts of water and resources that are used to extract gold. Michael, do you have a way of describing to us how much gold is in every ton of earth? Do you understand that mining question as somebody who buys gold? What kind of proportions are we talking about here?
I don't know the specifics, but there's an enormous the amount of a statistic often cited is that to make one gold wetting band takes multiple tons of raw ore that eventually has to be processed. So the yield, you said it earlier, Joel,
yeah.
You did. It is microscopic, and if you've not seen. The enormity of an open pit mine in Bingham Canyon in Utah is a good example. It really is staggering. The old idea of a fellow digging with a hammer and chipping out gold, it couldn't be further from the truth. It's an enormous earth-moving operation that no matter how well you do it, and a lot of people do try to do it well, I think we need to say that, it's a dirty, nasty business.
Conceded statistic about which there's no dispute is that less than 1% of the mass of Earth is actual mineral that they can make something out. So that's why you get 10 billion tons of waste. And it's critical to understanding the economics of this particular mine. Some people say, well, maybe they'll just do a smaller mine. And the reality is for this project to pencil out, they have to do this massive mine because it's in the middle of pristine wilderness. They have to build the entire infrastructure to make the mine work, very costly. And then they have to dig up massive quantities of earth in order to get enough actual minerals to make it worth their financial while. That's the problem. That's why Pebble has never been developed before. And only now, with the world's largest mining companies participating in the partnership, is it a possibility? But I think it's far from a given that the technology exists actually to accomplish it. They say that it does, but in order to make it work, there's a remarkable amount of destruction associated with the operation.
You know, and just one other in a little bit of defense of the jewelry industry here, because the price of gold is where it has. Is today not because of jewelry demand, because of financial speculation. I think that's an important point to understand. We're not looking at the price of gold because it's going to be used for jewelry. We're looking at it because of financial speculation. So if you want another reason to get mad at Wall Street, you have one.
Somebody would like to know which government agency will make the final decision to approve or disapprove the Pebble project.
Well, I think it'll be the courts, honestly. I think anything happens, we'll be going through the court system. But the 60-some permits that Pebble really needs, a lot of it will come from the state of Alaska. The discharge under the Clean Water Act that they need to move that raw or that waste, and they need to put it somewhere. Where they're going to put it, if you've watched those photos, is in wetlands. And so the company will say, well, and we've heard them say this, we'll put the wet, the material and the waste rock in wetlands, but we'll come down to the lower 48, and if you've got some wetlands that we need to fix up, well, we have a deal for you. So they'll exchange and take ours away just to give somebody else theirs back. It's the same with salmon. They'll say the same thing. We'll take away your salmon here, but geez, in Alaska they have great salmon populations, but we may have to go somewhere else to find and help you with your salmon population. So the question for us is, why should we, at the expense of something else, have to give up so somebody else can have it? And it's just unacceptable. And so for us, it's just a no.
I'm going to agree with Kim's assessment that the courts will likely be the ones to decide this, but there are state permits, in particular the Alaska Department of Natural Resources has lead authority. On the federal side, it's the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers under Section 404C of the Clean Water Act. And EPA also has authority under Section 404 to intervene and to veto, even before a permit has been applied for, under circumstances that we believe exist there. So EPA has been asked to come in. The Pebble Partnership wants EPA to stay out of it until they can file their permit with the Army Corps of Engineers, and they would obviously prefer to let that process run its course. We're hoping that Lisa Jackson will move forward with the petitions that she's received once the watershed assessment has been completed sometime in the spring of 2012.
Any final comments from anybody on the panel? I have a very nice thing I'd like to read that somebody's written here, but do you have any final wrap-ups, anything you haven't said?
Thank you for giving up your evening.
This is just very sweet. Somebody wrote, having grown up in Seward, Alaska, I've seen the salmon nearly disappear in the rivers and streams when one could not see the bottom for all the fish. So that has already happened in certain places. Let's not see it happen here.
What a very thoughtful way to end this very interesting panel. And I really, for myself, have appreciated very much our panel being here and sharing their information with us. I have to tell you, though, I have this great fear that at some point tonight, instead of saying Pebble Mine, I'm going to say Pebble Beach. So I want to get over that fear really quick. But our thanks to Wendy Schmidt, the Schmidt Family Foundation, Mike Koloski from the chairman and CEO of Tiffany, Kimberly Williams, and she's going to teach me how to say it right, Namada Aluskai. Am I still off? I'm still off, yes. Uh-oh. But she's a teacher, so I know I'm going to learn this. And Joel Reynolds from NRDC. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, and the Internet. I'm Ann Clark. I'm co-chair of the Natural and Environment and Natural Resources Forum. And we have given this program in cooperation with our Business and Leadership Forum. So we invite you to come back to the Commonwealth for the same wonderful kind of program that we have tonight. But I really do personally want to thank the panel. I have learned a lot, and I want to thank Kimberly, because I think oftentimes we talk about things on a intellectual, theoretical basis, and we don't often hear the personal experiences of people who are really living through the experience that faces them and us, because ultimately it will face us too. So Kimberly, thank you for coming from Alaska and sharing that. It was special for me. And so on behalf of the Commonwealth Club, this meeting is now adjourned. Thank you.